Consider this, vanguard of national troops, with trains of artillery, of pikemen and pike women, mounted on cannons, on carts, hackney coaches, or on foot, loaves stuck on the points of bayonets, green boughs stuck in gun barrels. Next, as main march, 50 cartloads of corn, which have been lent for peace from the stores of Versailles, behind which follow stragglers of the Garde du Corps, all humiliated, in grenadier bonnets. Close on these comes the royal carriage. Come royal carriages, for there are 100 national deputies, too, among whom sits Mirabeau, his remarks not given. Then, finally, pell-mell, as rearguard, Flandre, Swiss, 100 Swiss, other bodyguards, brigands, whosoever can't get before. Between and among all which masses flows without limit Saint-Antoine and the Menedic cohort. Menedic especially about the royal carriage, covered with tricolour, singing elusive songs, pointing with one hand to the royal carriage, which the illusions hit, and pointing to the provision wagons with the other hand, and these words, courage, friends, we shall not want bread now, we're bringing you the baker, the bakeress, and the baker's boy. The wet day draggles the tricolour, but the joy is unextinguishable. Is not all well now? Ah, madame, notre bonne reine, said some of these strong women some days hence. Ah, madame, our good queen, don't be a traitor any more, and we will all love you. This was October the 6th, 1789. For nearly 2 years the royal family dwelt unmolested in the Tuileries. Had the court kept common faith with the people, the king might have died there, a king. From 1789 to 1791 the early revolution held its own. France was a limited monarchy, the king kept a diminished state in the Tuileries, and the National Assembly ruled a country at peace. The reader who will glance back to the maps of Poland we have given in the previous chapter will realize what occupied Russia, Prussia, and Austria at this time. While France experimented with a crowned republic in the West, the last division of the crowned republic of the East was in progress. France could wait. When we consider its inexperience, the conditions under which it worked, and the complexities of its problems, one must concede that the Assembly did a very remarkable amount of constructive work. Much of that work was sound and still endures. Much was experimental and has been undone. Some was disastrous. There was a clearing up of the penal code. Torture, arbitrary imprisonment, and persecutions for heresy were abolished. The ancient provinces of France, Normandy, Burgundy, and the like gave place to 80 departments. Promotion to the highest ranks in the army was laid open to men of every class. An excellent and simple system of law courts was set up, but its value was much vitiated by having the judges appointed by popular election for short periods of time. This made the crowd a sort of final court of appeal, and the judges, like the members of the Assembly, were forced to play to the gallery. And the whole vast property of the church was seized and administered by the state. Religious establishments not engaged in education or works of charity were broken up, and the salaries of the clergy made a charge upon the nation. This in itself wasn't a bad thing for the lower clergy in France, who were often scandalously underpaid in comparison with the richer dignitaries. But in addition, the choice of priests and bishops was made elective, which struck at the very root idea of the Roman Church, which centred everything upon the Pope, and in which all authority is from above downward. Practically the National Assembly wanted at one blow to make the Church in France Protestant, in organization, if not in doctrine. Everywhere there were disputes and conflicts between the state priests created by the National Assembly and the recalcitrant non-juring priests who were loyal to Rome. One curious thing the National Assembly did, which greatly weakened its grip on affairs, it decreed that no member of the Assembly should be an executive minister. This was in imitation of the American Constitution, where also ministers are separated from the legislature. The British method has been to have all ministers in the legislative body ready to answer questions and account for their interpretation of the laws and their conduct of the nation's business. If the legislature represents the sovereign people, then it's surely necessary for the ministers to be in the closest touch with their sovereign. This severance of the legislature and executive in France caused misunderstandings and mistrust. The legislature lacked control, and the executive lacked moral force. This led to such an ineffectiveness in the central government that in many districts at this time, communes and towns were to be found that were practically self-governing communities. They accepted or rejected the commands of Paris as they thought fit, declining the payment of taxes, and divided up the church lands according to their local appetites. 10th. It's quite possible that with the royal support of the crown and a reasonable patriotism on the part of the nobility, the National Assembly, in spite of its noisy galleries, its Rousseauism and its inexperience, might have blundered through to a stable form of parliamentary government for France. In Mirabeau it had a statesman with clear ideas of the needs of the time. He knew the strength and the defects of the British system, and apparently he'd set himself to establish in France a parallel political organization upon a wider, more honest franchise. He had, it's true, indulged in a sort of Ruritanian flirtation with the Queen, seen her secretly, pronounced her very solemnly the only man about the King, and made rather a fool of himself in that matter. But his schemes were drawn upon a much larger scale than the scale of the back stairs of the Tuileries. By his death in 1791, France certainly lost one of her most constructive statesmen, and the National Assembly its last chance of any cooperation with the King. When there is a court, there is usually a conspiracy, and royalist schemes and royalist mischief-making were the last straw in the balance against the National Assembly. The royalists didn't care for Mirabeau. They didn't care for France. They wanted to be back in their lost paradise of privilege, haughtiness, and limitless expenditure. And it seemed to them that if only they could make the government of the National Assembly impossible, then by a sort of miracle the dry bones of the ancient regime would live again. They had no sense of the other possibility, the gulf of the republican extremists that yawned at their feet. One June night in 1791, between 11 o'clock and midnight, the King and Queen and their two children slipped out of the Tuileries disguised, threaded their palpitating way through Paris, circled round from the north of the city to the east, and got at last into a travelling carriage that was waiting upon the road to Châlons. They were flying to the Army of the East. The Army of the East was loyal, that's to say its general and officers at least were prepared to betray France to the King and court. Here was adventure at last after the Queen's heart, and one can understand the pleasurable excitement of the little party as the miles lengthened between themselves and Paris. Away over the hills were reverence, deep bows, and the kissing of hands. Then back to Versailles, a little shooting of the mob in Paris, artillery if need be, a few executions, but not of the sort of people who matter. A white terror for a few months, then all would be well again. Perhaps Cologne might return, too, with fresh financial expedients. He was busy just then gathering support among the German princes. There were a lot of chateaux to rebuild, but the people who burnt them down could hardly complain if the task of rebuilding them pressed rather heavily upon their grimy necks. All such bright anticipations were cruelly dashed that night at Varennes. The King had been recognized at Saint-Menehould by the landlord of the post-house, and as the night fell, the eastward roads clattered with galloping messengers, rousing the country and trying to intercept the fugitives.